You guys know I'm crazy about Audible because it offers an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. Audible really is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment, with female writers and heroines, celebrity narration, multicast productions with immersive sound design, and traditional audiobooks. Audible has you covered for any type of excitement that you're looking for. In fact, right now I'm listening to The Second Husband by Kate White. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. That's audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. With four daughters and two on a dance team, I can tell you we go through a lot of mascara in my house. But I'm crazy about L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, which catches every lash from corner to corner for maximum volume. If you're looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank, this is yours. The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. I've been using it for about 2 weeks now, and I feel like my eye has completely opened up, and the girls are crazy about it too. They've got a tapered brush to catch every lash, one of the best mascara wands that I've ever used. And like I said, this luxe appearance of this gold package, you got to get it. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today. L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, you're going to love it. Welcome back to another episode of Reality Life with Kate Casey. Did you see that Linda Tripp passed away this week? Linda Tripp was a civil servant who played a very prominent role in the Clinton-Lewinsky scandal. She became a close confidant of Monica Lewinsky. They were both former White House employees who both worked at the Pentagon's Public Affairs Office. And according to Linda Tripp, who was about 24 years older than Monica, they had known each other for about a year and a half before the scandal began to reach its critical stage. After Lewinsky revealed to Tripp that she had been in a physical relationship with the President of the United States, Tripp, acting on the advice of a literary agent, Lucienne Goldberg, began to secretly record phone conversations with Lewinsky while encouraging her to document details of her relationship with the president. Her action in secretly recording Monica Lewinsky's confidential phone calls about her relationship with the president caused a sensation with their links to the earlier Clinton versus Jones lawsuit and with the disclosing of intimate details. Linda Tripp always claimed that her motives were purely patriotic, and she was able to avoid a wiretap charge in exchange for handing in the tapes, which of course will live in infamy. She then claimed that her firing from the Pentagon at the end of the Clinton administration was vindictive, while the administration called it standard procedure for a political appointee. Now, as some of you know, I was an intern at the White House right before this story broke. As part of my job, I would bring the news clips to the President of the United States and members of the executive team before the sun had risen in the morning in the executive offices in the Oval Office. I was a political science undergraduate at Trinity College, and I can remember at the time believing with absolute certitude that there was no way anyone could engage in an affair, given how many staff members followed the president and the security of the building. I mean, I had a big fat A badge. I had somebody following me. I never was alone, could imagine anybody alone. Now, I've listened to the slow burn episodes, the podcast episodes, the retelling of the story. I have seen the A&E docuseries, The Clinton Affair. Obviously, now I see things through a different lens as a woman and not a college student, a young woman, a young college student. And I can say that I have far more compassion for Monica all these years later. But my utter shock, disappointment, and disgust for Linda Tripp had never wavered. It seems like time made her no less sympathetic. But that said, I was shocked to hear that she had passed. She was such an iconic figure in American political scandal. And I know that Monica had written a tweet yesterday saying that she had thought that despite what had transpired, that her heart was with her Linda's family, which I thought was incredibly gracious considering what happened all those years ago. But Linda Tripp was such a huge figure in American political life for so long. And I had almost, you know, kind of forgotten about her because she's not part of the, you know, the vernacular all the time. And just very strange to see that she had passed. Anyway, go back and watch that A&E docuseries, The Clinton Affair. Very, very interesting. Another fantastic docuseries that I'm watching is on HBO, and it's called Atlanta's Missing and Murdered the Lost Children. It's a 5-part documentary series offering an unprecedented look at the abduction and murder of at least 30 African-American children and young adults in Atlanta between 1979 and 1981. So 40 years later, with the official reopening of the case by Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms, the series tells the inside story of the shocking tragedy, shedding new light on the horrific killings through exclusive archival material, as well as interviews with those closest to the children and investigation. This series is interesting because it tracks the story from the initial disappearance and discovery of two murdered teenage boys to the fear that progressively gripped the city, ultimately building to the indictment and prosecution of a 23-year-old man named Wayne Williams, who was found guilty of murdering two adults while also being linked to the murders of 10 children. Days after Williams was sentenced to 2 life terms, most of the children's cases were closed and attributed to Williams without ever going to trial. Further, it details the rush to officially shut down the case and continuing deluge of questions that remained unanswered, including how the victims' family members, along with many others in the Atlanta community, remain skeptical of Williams' guilt. And then the documentary series also points to alternative suspects and details the biases and unexplored leads that many have that may have tainted the original investigation. I know that it's been covered on Mindhunter. There's also been a podcast about it, but this series is really fascinating because you are seeing archival footage, and there's nothing better than that. And I had the great privilege on Monday to interview the directors. I'm really excited about it. So I want you to watch that. It's called Atlanta's Missing and Murdered. I also got a note from HBO that there is a great new documentary that's going to come out May 5th. It's called Natalie Wood, What Remains Behind. So Natalie Wood's remarkable life and career are often overshadowed by the circumstances surrounding her tragic death at age 43. You will remember that she was with her husband and they were fighting on a boat in Catalina and she fell off the boat and presumably drowned. Lots of people forget about her incredible career. So guided by her daughter, Natasha Gregson-Wagner, who, by the way, is a spitting image of her mother, as well as her extensive circle of family and close friends, the film intimately explores Wood's personal life and illustrious career that spanned nearly 5 decades, chronicling her triumphs and challenges, featuring previously unseen home movies, which I love those, photographs, diaries, and letters, as well as interviews with those that knew her best. So I'm really looking forward to that as well. I am also looking forward to the ABC show called The Bachelor, Tell It to Your Heart. It's going to be like The Bachelor, but add in singers. It sounds like a phantom. Now, I've said that word before. I don't know if you remember it, but it's like when you're looking at someone from afar and you're cringing, you're having a shame attack as you watch them do something that you're almost like feeling embarrassed for them. I have a feeling it might be like that. And for that, I'm excited because that's great TV watching. So this episode, I'm really excited about because I got a chance to talk to Steve Berkowitz, who is a very accomplished TV producer. And he worked on a couple different shows that I was dying to talk to him about. One of them is called Extreme Home Makeover. You guys love these renovation shows. And I've always wondered what goes on behind the scenes of a show like that. And he also worked on The Rachel Zoe Project, which was on Bravo, a behind-the-scenes look at Rachel Zoe's life. And what I think is so interesting about that show is I think it was a little bit ahead of its time. The first season of the show, I felt like it was a little bit more about her relationship with these assistants who were trying to carve out their own careers. Brad Goreski obviously has gone on to become quite famous and a celebrated stylist. And it was really more about the demise of their friendship, their working relationship, and consequently their friendship. And then after that, it really focused on this woman who was building what would become an incredible brand. And she was at the time, kind of juggling becoming a new parent and her marriage. And I think that it was, as I mentioned, a little bit up ahead of its time, because it was really like the beginning of, in my opinion, the girl boss movement. So women wanting to see other incredible women building incredible companies featured on television shows. And I don't think we do enough to say thank you to Rachel for that. I mean, she had some great one-liners like it's bananas, that kind of stuff. But I can only imagine that there are a tremendous amount of women who aspire to have a career in the fashion industry from watching her show. So hats off to Rachel Zoe. So it's a great interview with Steve. I hope you enjoy. And here we go. Steve Berkowitz is a producer and director and a host. He's worked on several unscripted TV shows, and I'm thrilled to have him as a guest. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
How did you get your start in television?
Okay, so my path to reality television is a little different than a lot of people's. I came out of college and I went into news, like local news, and eventually got into sports and being on camera as a reporter, anchor, producer. I went to three different stations, Tiny Town, Johnstown, Pennsylvania, and then went to Morgantown, West Virginia, and then ended up in the Bristol Johnson City market in Tennessee. And I really was the do-it-all guy, pick up the camera and shoot, report, anchor, edit, write. I did everything. And I made very little money. But what I did do is I learned pretty much everything you need to know about making content. What was nice is this was right around 2004, and reality television was really starting to take off. And ESPN had dipped their toe into the reality television world, and they were doing this show called I'd Do Anything, which was really just a Fear Factor with sports. And I got very fortunate in that someone named Scott Messick, who had been the supervising producer and director on season one of Survivor. And Scott had really been kind of a guy who went from MTV Sports and so to then Survivor, and really had this way of doing sports mixed with big reality shows as well. He saw something in me as a kid who could also do sports in reality. And so he took me under his wing. He put me on that show as an associate producer. That was my first job. And he really took me for 2 years. And I did shows like Pros versus Joes and this crazy demolition derby show in Florida called Carpocalypse for what was then Spike and is now the Paramount Network. And I did a lot of those kind of sports mixed with reality shows for about 2 years. And what it really did was it kind of helped me transition from the way you tell stories as a sports reporter, as a sports producer, to how you tell things as a reality television producer, as an unscripted producer. And so it was a great kind of way of cutting my teeth and just going from associate producer to story producer and field producer in a pretty quick period of time.
And then you ended up working on Extreme Makeover Home Edition.
Yeah, so Extreme Makeover Home Edition really was the big break for me in my career. And truthfully, you look at a lot of great producers in unscripted television, they would say the same thing. And so that came about really, I interviewed three times to be a producer on Extreme Makeover Home Edition. And I was very fortunate that third time I got the job. And I was, I think some people jump in on that show and they drink the Kool-Aid right away and they're all in. Yeah, no, it's one of those shows. It is. It's the feel good show.
Yeah.
And,
definitely.
You're helping community. Yeah. You are helping communities. You're helping a family each week that has been through something difficult, but they're also very deserving because they help their community in one way or another. And I'm a kind of a cynical, skeptical guy, but what I will always remember is that very first time that, you get in and my job that very first season, I was what we called like a show producer. And so I owned an episode from a story perspective. So I was in charge of interviewing the family and, telling the story from the family's perspective. And I'll never forget the first time that I saw that bus move. And I'm not an emotional guy, but when you see that move and you see a family's life change in an instant,
yeah,
there is something visceral. Yeah, there's something visceral that reacts when you see a whole community support that family and you're live and you're there. And for, you know, we would, the crew of producers and the director would all be in this tight little box watching it happen. So we would be taking notes as well as talking to each other about what shots we needed, et cetera, what sound bites we needed. And you would have four grown men crying at the same time.
I believe it.
So, yes, it was always. And so, you know, I look back on that and I did two seasons of that. And it was, I truly look back on it as the best experience of my career, and being able to meet some incredible families, worked with some amazing celebrities like David Duchovny and Jewel. We had Reese Witherspoon on a show. We had Katy Perry on a show. We had Shaquille O'Neal on a show. So we worked with some great celebrities, but most importantly, the communities. I saw some things that, you know, we live in a very skeptical age, a very cynical age, very divisive. I think Extreme Makeover: Home Edition, and it's good that it's back now. And I've talked to a lot of people who are working on the current version. It is the proof that we can put our differences aside and rally around a family that is in trouble and needs help, and we can, you know, help one another and make something good happen.
Now, that seems like there are a lot of hurdles that you have to overcome. It feels like you're in a race against time. Do you also have to rely at all on outside donations? It looks like the people in the community oftentimes wanted to be involved, but did you ever have a situation where you're like, I hope to God somebody pulls through and brings us lumber?
Yeah. So, I mean, that whole show is built on volunteer work from about 1,000 people who help build the house, as well as, you know, a builder who donates for free, basically donates his team and his work for free in order to make the house, right? Free labor, free work is what it's built on, as well as huge donations from big companies. Back when I did it, it was, you know, your Sears, your CVS, all these huge companies that were donating product. And the same is true now. In fact, on the new version, HGTV, you know, that was something very foreign to them, and they've had to adapt in terms of allowing for trade outs like that. But the show exists because you have, whether it's individuals who are giving up their time for free to help build the house, or big companies or even small companies who are giving away free product, like you said about, you know, whether it's roofing or doors or paint, it all has to be donated. We would have a very small budget in terms of actually going and buying product. Most of it, it's not a large majority of it, was actually donated that we, you know, we would call trade outs, where we would show a logo or use a verbal mention during the show. And that would, you know, be what this company or these people would get in return for their labor or their products. And I think that went to the good nature of the show and what it meant to help this particular family each week.
I think of that show all the time when I pass a house under construction. Because, I mean, how many friends do you have that are having nightmare issues with contractors and you think, oh my God, Extreme Makeover, they built a house in like a week.
Yeah, I agree with you 1,000,000%. I will never understand when people are like, oh, you know, my house is going up and it's been 6 months and they're so far behind. I can never, I cannot fathom that, because I used to see a house get built in a week. And actually, it's only 5 days. Like, we would say it was seven, but it's really only 5 days that they actually are building it. Because remember, you have to tear it down. So like day one, we would surprise them. Day two, we would tear it down. So we really didn't, we would kind of start to rebuild the house on day two, but really it didn't start getting rebuilt until day three. So you really are only building the house in 5 days, which is truly a testament to the precision of the build team.
Unbelievable. All right. What is the one family that you will never forget?
The Creasy family. Season 7, North Carolina. Trisha Creasy was the teacher of the year, and she had stage 4 colon cancer. The entire town knew who Trisha Creasy was, whether she had taught them, she was teaching their kid. And it was just an amazing family. She had these two cute twins, and then another teenage daughter. Her husband, William, also worked in the school district, and they met, you know, through being, you know, educators. And I immediately fell in love with them. And it was, as a producer, it was not the easiest thing to deal with, you know, someone who was truly, she was dying. Mm-hmm. And it was my first season on the show. And so, as I was saying, most people had drank the Kool-Aid, and this was my first kind of experience with, whoa, like, this is very serious and I don't know how I'm going to do this. And I really connected with her on a level of like, this was a woman who was so brave and so strong, so courageous, and her community rallied around her. And I just was inspired by her. And today, I will say it was the best interview I've ever done. I put the computer down, put all my notes down, and I talked to this woman for 2 hours. She stared down, you know, all the fears that she had about losing her family and losing her life. And she was so inspiring for me that, like, I will always remember that. I still stay in touch with that family. She has since passed. Oh. But, you know, I stay in touch on Facebook, and I see now the oldest daughter is in college, and, you know, I see the two twins growing up, and I stay in touch with the father.
So one of the other shows that you worked on, it's just like a cult following. People are still obsessed with it. It was the Rachel Zoe Project. That's obviously quite different from Extreme Makeover. What was that show like?
Yes, Rachel is a phenomenal stylist and designer, and she is, you know, goes a mile a minute. And when I came on the show, I was the supervising producer and director, and you know, she had transitioned. She was still had her celebrity stylist business. So at that time, I believe she was doing styling Jennifer Lawrence. She was styling Ava Mendez, amongst several other people. But she also was full on running her company, you know, her design company. And so we were really covering two major business stories. It was a true occupational docuseries. We also were dealing, you know, with her family. She had a kid. And so it was a really difficult show to do from the standpoint of we were constantly trying to, you know, follow the craziness going on in her office, as well as, you know, getting access to her family because she is a private person. I think the toughest part about that show was, you know, getting the celebrities to open up to us and even getting the celebrities to allow us to be, you know, to allow us to film with them. But Rachel is amazing. Roger, her husband, Roger Berman, her husband, were tremendous. They were both tremendous characters, as well as just great in terms of allowing us to film. But I would say the difference between the two shows was the way we shot them. I mean, the Rachel Zoe Project, when I came on, we really shot that like a true docuseries. She really made it clear she did not want to do second takes. It was like you get it or you don't. And so it was really incumbent upon me to get my cameras in the right place and to make sure that we got what she wanted. We got what the executive producer at the time wanted and what Bravo wanted. And so we really had to be on our toes. We really had to follow not just what she was saying, but what she wanted us to see and what the audience wanted us to see, the beautiful clothes, the models, the celebrities, everything that we, you know, that the fans had grown to love. There was no time to screw up. There was no time to waste. We really had to be on our toes.
So it seemed like the first season, it was more of a reality show and people were more caught up in the relationships with the former assistants. And then it did seem like as a viewer, she really wanted people to focus in the subsequent seasons on her business story, being this entrepreneur. And I do feel like there are so many women that look to her as inspiration because of that show.
I would agree. I mean, I think she, you know, that term like boss lady or, you know, girl boss was, you know, has since come about, but Rachel truly was, you know, a boss. And like, I used to watch her come in and everybody would talk to her. The job, you know, that whole business, that whole place revolved around her, and she handled it with grace and was really just awesome to watch. And it was a joy to film with her. I loved shooting at their office. We'd shoot through glass. Watching her was awesome, and being able to work with her and Roger, they play off each other so well. But the juggling act with her, seeing how she was a mom, seeing how she ran the design on one side, as well as the styling, and having that balance. And then also, going out at night and mingling with the celebrity world. It really was amazing to see her balance it all. And then for us to try and tell those stories, mix them all together, was always a challenge. The one story I will tell about that is, like, I was not a fashion guy. I was absolutely not. So this was learning. Oh, 100%. I was not. So, like, and truthfully, like, if you've ever dealt with anyone who works in that world, like, you cannot just walk in a pair of flip flops
No.
So my executive producer at the time looked me over right before we were about to meet Rachel for the very first time. And he told me, he said, go shopping this weekend. He said, I don't care. He said, take your credit card out and just buy 5 new outfits, because she is not going to be happy if you look like this. I bought $1,300 worth of clothes before I met Rachel. So.
I believe it.
Thank God I did. Yes, thank God I did.
So then from there, you go on to a show like Outdaughtered. I mean, you thought Rachel Zoe with one child was a lot. Was that like birth control?
It was absolutely birth control. It was hilarious. And also, like, I think I was deaf for a certain period of time, because, you know, we would have, you know, our headphones on and listening to 5 babies cry for about 4 months straight. Yes, you definitely are like, I have zero desire to be a father after all this. But I loved that show. I truly enjoyed my experience. I was the showrunner on season 2, and I love Adam and Danielle, and really enjoy working with TLC. And the creator of that show, Brett Bilgart, has become a really good friend of mine. And I really enjoy what that show kind of has done for TLC, and what being able to tell a story like that, where you have a couple parents who were thrown into a situation, you know, they all of a sudden ended up, and you went from having 1 kid to 6, and, you know, how they deal with that. And I think that is a tremendous story. And what we did that season 2, to be able to give the little babies characters, and to see how Adam and Danielle react, you know, dealing with 5 little quintuplets is overwhelming. And you just never know what's going to happen.
How do they protect Danielle and Adam from, I mean, obviously the John and Kate plus 8 was before them. That was probably a huge learning experience for the network, and obviously for the production company to have them as an example. How did you kind of protect them that their family remained intact and they didn't fall through the same holes as John and Kate?
Well, one, different production companies, different producers. And then two, I just think completely different situation. Every human being is different. Every relationship is different.
That's true.
The two of them had a very strong relationship. They're both church-going people, and they live around family. One of the key things to that show is how big Danielle's family is in that, whether it's her mom or whether it's her 2 sisters, and then the surrounding family that goes along with that. So I think that whole family element keeps them very grounded. It keeps them from getting, you know, out of their element, if you will. And they really are kind of just this, you know, we would always say, you know, and I think you find this with all the good TLC shows, is they're just like your family, but they're thrown into an extraordinary situation. You know, they're an ordinary family thrown into an extraordinary situation. And it's, how do you deal with that? And I think they, you know, it's a perfect example. They're still on the air and they're still together. And I think it's a testament to them and to their family.
And so now you're still in production, but kind of behind the scenes doing other projects. I'm dying to know this question, because you see a lot of sizzle reels. if I see another sizzle about you fill in the blank.
Yeah. So, I mean, I did 2 years of development and so I did a lot of sizzle reels as well as seeing a lot of sizzle reels. And so I think for me, it's if I see another sizzle that this is an Anthony Bourdain four ... my head is going to explode. Yeah.
Yeah.
And rest in peace. There is only one Anthony Bourdain.
Right.
And I think once the man passed, it was this mad dash to find another Anthony Bourdain. They're like, well, we can just find another great person to do a travelogue with and then fill in the blank. It's, you know, it's Anthony Bourdain for cars. It's Anthony Bourdain for music. It's Anthony Bourdain for love. And it's like that formula doesn't necessarily work for everything. He was one of a kind. He really was. And like just saying it's that is not like, doesn't solve anything and doesn't sell the show. And I've heard that so many times that it's almost like a knee jerk reaction. I'm like, oh God, please no.
That's like casting directors for Real Housewives always tell me, if I see another cast suggestion and the woman has started her own bikini line, I'm going to slam my head against a wall. It's like, yeah, it's just like the trope. Always. How do you think reality TV is changing since you began? Or unscripted TV?
Well, it's changed a lot since the Wild Wild West days, you know, whether it's the budgets, which back then, you know, we had big budgets. And now I think obviously budgets have shrank and people are a little bit more cautious about what you're allowed to do. And also there's more networks, more platforms, you have the streaming aspect. I think we're almost though back to where we started in terms of big hooks, big name celebrities being back in the game and really finding a format or an idea that can cut through the clutter. And I'll use two examples, being The Circle and Love is Blind. And it's not like either one of those are revolutionary, mm-hmm. but they have a different look mm-hmm. and a different hook that really grabbed an audience. And it's just a younger take on a familiar genre, whether, you know, you could look at The Circle and you could say, oh, it's just like Big Brother 2.0, but it found a young audience and people really enjoy that show. Love is Blind, you know, it has elements of Married at First Sight and it has elements of The Bachelor and a number of other dating shows, but the new look and really touching into that idea that the younger crowd does start a lot of relationships just by texting each other, just by DMing each other, just on dating apps, and they don't really meet, you know, they have to take that big step. I think touched something in our culture that made it such a massive hit for Netflix. And so I think things have changed in a way that you really just, you know, they've changed because they're a little bit more back to where we started from looking at what's that big hook? What's that next big thing that that we're going for? And I think you got to find that thing that cuts through the clutter.
So tell me what you're working on now.
So right now I have a podcast just like you. Mine's called No Script, No Problem. It's on the Bleav Podcast Network. You can find it on Apple Podcasts. You can find it on Spotify or Stitcher. And I'm doing my first feature documentary. I don't want to totally get into it, but it does have a, you know, we're dealing with a health crisis right now, and it does touch on a silent killer in the health world. And so I'm very excited. I've never done a full feature documentary. And so this is a big step for me and I'm very excited about it. And it turns out we're in quarantine and kind of the perfect time to be an edit on a documentary feature.
And I will say, you told me a little bit about it and it sounds really interesting. And I know that everyone will be rushing to see it. I'm excited about it.
Thank you. Thank you. I hope so.
I know so. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Steve. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. This has been awesome.
The amazing Kate Casey.
I want to thank my great guest, Steve Berkowitz. and remind everybody that I also have a Patreon page if you want to listen to bonus episodes. You can go to patreon.com/KateCasey. I do a ton of true crime and society stuff from like Vanity Fair. You can join the Facebook group. You could put in Reality Life with Kate Casey in the search button. You can follow me on Twitter at Kate Casey. I am tweeting about shows, during shows all week long, and also passing on great information about people like, did you just read the story about Tyler Perry? He paid in advance for a bunch of seniors to have all of their groceries paid for this week in Atlanta. So they went early in the morning, you know, they have their shopping carts and their masks on, and they buy a ton of groceries only to find out from the cashier that Tyler Perry has paid the whole thing. And he did it in secrecy, but somebody apparently spilled the beans, and he's apparently done it before in other cities like New Orleans. So I don't know. There's so many great things on Twitter. And I think for some people, it overwhelms them, but it's a fantastic social media platform. Sure, there are crazy people that are screaming about the election all the time, and I get it because I'm fired up too. But there are also a lot of really funny people that are passing on really valuable information. I believe sometimes it's like you can get up to date news information that sometimes takes a little longer to filter through when you just kind of search. And also just like funny people that are passing on good stories, funny stories. So check that out. I swear to God, Twitter did not pay me to say that. I just happen to really love Twitter. And then, of course, you can check out my Instagram at KateCasey. My God, if you guys have something funny that you're doing at home, a clever way to kind of pass the time, please send me your pictures. I really love it. I love to see everyone else's, like, a window into your life. Consider yourselves reality stars of your own house and give me a window into what's going on at your house. Listen, we're all in this together. So I will circle back with you next week. My next interview is with the directors of Atlanta's Missing and Murdered Lost Children. Have a great weekend.
Listen to the 48 Hours podcast for shocking murder cases and compelling real-life dramas from one of television's most watched true crime shows. Go behind the scenes of each episode with award-winning CBS News correspondents and producers in Postmortem, a weekly deep dive. Listen to 48 Hours wherever you get your podcasts.